Good evening and welcome to the Freeburg third quarter conference call. I'm David Rothberg, and with me is Al Freeburg. Al, good evening. How are you tonight?
Good evening, David. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So a little bit of housekeeping before we start. First off, I have to confess that I am moderating this meeting in my car. My wife's driving. We're driving through through Nova Scotia, heading home from Cape Breton to Toronto. And so I apologize if there is any interference as I'm driving. Secondly, I want to remind everyone that due to technical reasons, we really found it a lot easier to record the call and to post it rather than to do it live, as we did for many years. But in the interest of those people who want timely information, this call is being recorded at 7 o'clock Eastern Time on Sunday. I'll point out that for us, we are no longer active traders in the themes that we typically have in the Global Macro Fund. Al, you can correct me if I'm wrong, are much more long-term, much more secular than would be required of that kind of timeliness. But just in the interest of full disclosure, I'm saying this much. So let's get going, shall we?
Yes, sir.
So as is always the case, what we try and do here is I act as an interlocutor to a number of questions that are put to us by investors. And generally speaking, in responding to the questions, Albert will articulate the themes that he has embedded in the Global Macro Fund. So I'm just going to start with the first one. Which is to say, what do you see will be the major economic financial trends over the next 18 months or even 3 years? I think in answering that, Al, you're pretty well set up for the way the portfolio is situated now.
Okay, very good, David. All right, so, you know, we have to recognize that we are on the eve of an election, quite a momentous election possibly, and it could affect those major trends that we're talking about. So it's sort of a little bit difficult to make a full statement because of that. But let me say this, that with spending plans in place and with monetary policy in place, and with acknowledgement that monetary policy will stay accommodating for a long time to come, the major trends that we see happening are a restoration, or a full recovery of the economy, with different patterns of spending, of course, but a full recovery that I think that we will regain the lost ground maybe in the next year. And we will see strong inflationary pressures develop in the economy in this coming year. We are already beginning to see some of that. You know, normally people look at CPI. The problem with CPI, it's been pointed out in the past, is that CPI is an index that adjusts the basket in which they measure inflation very, very infrequently, every few years, I think. So it is an economy that's changed completely, changed its patterns of spending. And for example, there's been a huge demand, just one example, a huge demand for used cars. People want to have their own cars. They don't want to use public transportation. Well, the prices of used cars have gone up 6% in the last month. It's not a major factor in the CPI, but if one were to adjust the basket and adjust it to those items that people spend money on, not air travel, which prices have gone down, but nobody's traveling, but things that people want to have, one would already begin to see strong inflationary pressures. And the one index that is more likely to reflect that is the PCE. That is built in with a GNP. So you might be able to see already personal consumption expenditures. You might be able to see already that in the next figures, because that gets adjusted every few months. together with the revisions in GNP. So I think that you will see that. I think you will see inflation picking up. I think you will begin to see some resistance begin to develop, but very lightly. I don't think that anybody will take it very seriously for the first 3 or 6 months. It will become more of an issue later on. So for now, the trend should be in place. We're looking for economic conditions that will continue to improve, a recovery to the previous lost gains in output, and inflationary pressures. That's what we think is the main economic impact of what's in place already. There will be more impact in a different kind, more sectoral impact, after we know the outcome of the election.
Okay, I'm going to put to you a question that seeks to rebut that view to some extent. But before I do, I think that it now would be an appropriate time to describe how that view plays out in the portfolio as you have it now. Also, we'll start with the global macro, and then let's talk about the asset allocation side.
You mean how we intend to participate in this trend, right? That's what you mean.
Yeah. How do the two portfolios reflect the views that you just articulated?
Right. So we have been positioning the portfolio towards having a fairly large proportion in a risk ratio in a leverage ratio of almost 3-to-1 towards risk assets. Initially, the risk assets were stocks. Mostly growth stocks, gold, a little bit of commodities. Over time, we began to lower our stock exposure, except for the one sector that we've been very strong in, which is home builders. And I'll come back to that later. But other than home builders, we built up our exposure to gold and our exposure to commodities as a group. So they should be favorably affected by this trend, the inflationary trend, and the pickup in economic activity, which, by the way, it's not just the U.S. It's worldwide, and it probably led by China. I believe that we are very well positioned for that change to happen. And we are not going to be taking a chance on changes in economic policy that may affect corporate profits. So in some way, until we know better, and that may take a couple of months, in some way, stocks are not the best of the risk assets to own at the moment because of the possibility that changes coming down the pipe will do things to them. For example, we may see taxes, income taxes or corporate taxes being raised substantially, and that can diminish corporate profits by at least 10%. But there will be other kinds of costs involved too and taxes involved too, some of them not so visible, regulatory kinds of, let's call it regulatory types of taxes. So we believe that stocks will not be the most favorable asset to own in this next phase of the recovery. Home builders is a separate issue. They are they're in an incredible boom. There's a huge demand for single homes because of the pandemic and because of household formation, which had been extraordinary, and because of very cheap mortgage money. So the combination has made it extremely interesting to own these. And we might say that in addition to that, their multiples are very moderate. We're talking about multiples on forward earnings of next year between 7 and 11 times. And those are substantially lower than the forward earning multiples that you see and that we see now, even in cyclical sectors in the market. So that's for the global macro. For the asset allocation, it's a similar thing. We are long. Gold, but we are long gold miners, which is something that we don't own in the global macro. Gold miners represent an excellent value. consolidation is taking place in the industry. It will take place. It must take place. Reserves are falling. And so this is a necessity. And for the first time in a long time, these stocks are cheap. And we also own home builders. And of course, as I said, gold bullion. So both portfolios are extremely well positioned for what we see are the major trends for the next, at least for the next 18 months.
Okay, I vowed that I would put you a challenge to your inflationary view. Your view of inflation is largely monetary based. You see the broad aggregates growing at double digit rates in the 20% range. Now, rates that haven't been seen really in a generation. You're of a generation that saw that grew up with monetarism. We have a question from or a comment from an investor who points out that his firm believes that multiplying credit problems will pressure prices, keep us at an even keel, perhaps even cause a deflationary path. What do you think? I guess the question is, does the monetary view trump the credit argument?
Right. So let's repeat first the monetary argument. The monetary argument is that private money, and which is reflected in, for instance, indicators like M2, M1, M2, Divisia, those are growing today somewhere between 25 and 30% per annum. And those are extremely large increases. Those are much larger than we have seen since the 70s and probably even larger than what we saw in the 70s. So we have now a real life experiment in monetarism, because we have for the first time a out of ordinary expansion in money. It did not happen after 2009, 2010, despite QE, despite the Fed's efforts to subdue interest rates, to keep them very low, to make credit available. Money, for some reason, private money deposits did not increase, and we've talked about it in the past many times. There were technical reasons for that, et cetera. But we never really saw an expansion of private money deposits of this order. So it is very difficult for those who deny monetarism to say, well, we've seen this in the past and nothing happened. We actually have not seen this in the past, but the closest thing that we've seen in the past was in the 70s. And at the time, we did have double-digit inflation. So now we need to see what happens next. Credit, the issue of credit, and I think that it's a very interesting point. There's a lot of poor credits today. There's been the balance sheets have been weakened substantially in the last year. They were already weak before. They're now much weaker, because of the pandemic, because of the depression. And we are seeing extreme weaknesses in balance sheets. Now, these companies, I think over 25% of listed companies today are called zombies. Zombies are companies that cannot possibly service their debt out of earnings, out of cash flow. And the only way they do that is actually by borrowing more money. Now, zombies present a very interesting problem, because they continue to operate. They don't go bankrupt. They continue to operate. And by continuing to operate, they put pressure on existing and even solvent companies because of the competition that they provide. And so it has an effect on business. It has an effect on capital spending. It has an effect on the activity of the more solvent sector. That's true. And the other thing that it does is, because the credit conditions are poor, it makes these companies, these zombies, sell at maybe lower than justifiable prices. And so in that sense, they do provide a cap. They do provide some kind of a deflationary or disinflationary cap. And we have to take that into account because they are a factor in what's going on. But we got to remember that money finds a way to express itself. And it doesn't always find its way in one area that we think or in all areas. It finds ways in places where it can express itself. And for example, where money finds a way to express itself is in areas where there's structural problems, where there's supply problems. And so suddenly where there's supply problems, the prices will skyrocket in those areas, or in services that cannot be restrained easily, or in areas that are not or that are heavily protected by protectionist measures, high tariffs, for example, quotas, for example. So it's not easy to make a statement that credit pressures will keep a lid on prices, or credit problems will keep a lid on prices, because it may affect only certain, yes, but it may only affect certain sectors. But the excess money will begin to spill over into other sectors. So what we're looking at is the overall picture. The overall picture is one in which we will have intense price pressures on where people show demand. I gave an example before. Airline tickets today are probably cheaper because airlines are trying to sell tickets and try to get closer to break even. And that's an example where credit pressures are forcing them to credit stresses are forcing them to try to get as quickly as possible to break even and lowering prices. But as against that, you have other sectors where there's a boom and prices are rising very quickly. Since the majority of sectors in the United States are still operating at a profit, I think that you're going to expect there the price pressures to occur. So again, just to summarize, credit strains are deflationary or disinflationary where they occur in the sector that they occur. Yes, they are where they occur. They also have a deleterious effect on economic activity because they provide competition to companies that can expand and don't expand because of the activity of these zombies. But overall, since the majority of corporations are still operating at a profit and they're still offering products and products that are in demand, I think that you will see price pressures overcome this and net-net, we will see prices increase.
Okay. Let's turn to the bond market. If we're predicting or calling for inflation, it should be reflected in the long end, and it seems that it may very well be expressing itself in the long end. We saw the 10-year last week plunged, I think it was 90 basis points, which may seem insignificant historically, but when you consider that it's climbing off a base of, I think, a low of 65 basis points, that's quite a rise. If the long end of the market should increase, how does that affect your home builder's bet, and how does it also affect your gold bet? Do you think that is it something you're taking into consideration? Are there other games to play with the long end of the market rising like this? Do you think it's going to continue to rise? Do you think there'll be QE and that the Fed will step in and make sure and put a cap on long rates?
Okay. That's a fair question, and here's what we think happens. With the Fed holding on to the short end of the market and repressing the short end by just buying securities and keeping the short end low, what they accomplish is that we are beginning to see a steepening of the yield curve. So the very short end rates could be at 10 basis or 15 basis points or 20. At the 10-year, we're already up to 85, 90 maybe. And at the 30-year, we may be up to 140, 150. I haven't checked lately the numbers, but it's beginning to rise. That spread will continue to increase if we are right. If inflationary pressures persist and they get stronger, we're going to see the yield curve rise and steepen substantially. It wouldn't be impossible to see, it would be quite normal actually, to see the 30-year, for example, trade above 2% or about 2.5%. I mean, there's no reason why it shouldn't trade up to and higher than the rate of inflation. So there's no question about it that the yield curve will steepen and that rates are going higher at the long end. Now, if the Fed were not intervening, if the Fed were not repressing rates at the short end, I think the adjustment would take care much quicker. And I think that you would see 10-year and the 30-year move higher much faster. Because of repression, because of what the Fed is doing, they will be moving up, but they will be probably lagging the rate of inflation. That's the key for us. The key for us is, will rate rise, lag, or move ahead of the rate of inflation? The bet that we're making is that with the Fed holding tight and sort of putting their foot down on the very short end of the market, they will not really allow the market to do that. They will not allow the nominal rate at the long end to rise fast enough and to go above inflation, which means that the real rates, what we call real rates, rates after inflation, real rates will remain negative. That's the important point for our position. Real rates, when they become positive, especially when they become strongly positive, I don't mean when they become positive by a quarter percent, but if real rates were to become strongly positive, 200 basis points, 150, 200, 300 basis points, that affects economic activity, that affects inflation. The extreme example that we saw was the one that we have in recent history. When you say recent, I mean the last 40, 50 years, is the rate increase that took place under Volcker, who was the head of the Federal Reserve in 1980-81. At the time, he led short-term rates rise from about 8-9% to 22%. At the time, inflation was maybe in the double-digit area, maybe 9-12%. So you had real rates rise significantly. And actually, we had a period in which real rates were at 5, 6, 7% per annum. Today, they're negative. So to me, this is the main determinant of risk asset prices. That's the main determinant. The rest is all a question of selection. Which one will benefit the most? Should it be home builders? Should it be miners? Should it be commodities? Should it be growth companies? Which sectors among risk assets will benefit the most from negative rates? But generally, they all benefit, generally. Once rates become positive, once real rates become positive, and that takes a certain amount of, that takes a much more neutral Federal Reserve, right? Once rates become positive, then we have to start getting a little more concerned. And once they go above 200 or 250 or 300 basis points, then we know the risk assets are going to be turning down.
Okay, but unless the Fed becomes a buyer of longer-term fixed income securities, is it not possible that the yield curve could widen on its own so that at the long end of the market, rates were real? And if that were the case, would that not damage, really,
right, so,
tragically, so, a gold position and a position in housing?
Yeah, so really, the reality is that long-term rates cannot move away too far from short-term rates. They cannot. And one of the reasons they cannot is because there's always a temptation to do the carry. You can borrow money at the short end of the market. For example, dealers can borrow money today at very low rates, 5 basis points, 10 basis points, 20 basis points, and carry and buy bonds that yield 1.5% or 1.75% or 2%. The carry is so profitable, especially if you leverage it, that the temptation is there, and that keeps a lid on where the loan rates are going to go. So they're not likely to escape. We're not likely, it's not really likely to have a 0.25% Fed fund rate and a 500 basis point or 5% yield on long-term rates. The temptation to carry them and to make money on the carry is too strong, and it won't happen. That's why I say that until the Fed abandons that policy, you're not going to see those rates float fast enough upwards to get into positive rates.
Okay, let's turn to sectors. We have, I think, an historically wide gap between growth stocks and value stocks. You have a bifurcated view to value stocks, or let's say to cyclical stocks. They're not exactly the same, but they share many similarities. And I say that you have a bifurcated view in that you're long home builders, but you are short Australian banks. Do you have a view on cyclicals in general or on value stocks in general?
Well, let's say my view on cyclicals is that they will recover. Many of them will recover. Problem with the recovery is that many of them will recover, but they will be so weakened by what's happened that they may not be able to make money for the investor. To give a very simple example, the airlines seem to me like a prime example. They are losing very large amounts of money. They are taking on a tremendous amount of debt. There's a little question in my mind that in a year or two, traffic will be back to almost normal, either because of vaccine or because of herd immunity, or for some reason, people will continue, will increase their traveling, not business traveling so much, but probably tourism will increase sharply. So the thing is, though, will those airlines make money for investors? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that their weakened position will not cause them to issue a flood of stock to be able to write their balance sheets. And so maybe only those that have kept themselves or have been able to acquire the least amount of debt, maybe they will benefit. But there's going to be a lot of companies that will be burdened with tremendous amount of debt. And I think that they will not be attractive to investors. Banks are in a different category because, on the one hand, their profit margins are being squeezed. You know, the yield curve has been very flat, but now it's getting a little better, so that should be good. But on the other hand, regulation, heavy regulation is making them into almost like regulated industries, where the return on capital, return on equity is capped. I don't see banks being an attractive industry. So even though you might call it a cyclical industry, and it probably goes into the category of value stocks today, but I see them as more like a value trap in that sense. They are not attractive. They're just not attractive. The environment is not attractive for them. There are other sectors that are more attractive, and I think that we'll be able to see them. But we have to be very careful not to get caught on what's called value traps. I mean, I don't know if you've seen that one of the largest fund managers in value stocks just gave back $10 billion because he was creamed by the disparity between growth stocks and value stocks, and he felt that he can never recover. And so he gave back the money. And he's been talking about this idea that we may be in a situation of value traps in many of these stocks. Still, I do think that there will be opportunities in sectors, especially those that were managed not to be overburdened with debt, once you're overburdened with debt, you don't really have many choices. Probably the easiest choice is to issue a lot of stock, water down your ownership, and then you don't really make a lot of money, or go bankrupt, and somebody else will acquire the assets. So we have to be very careful. I think balance sheet analysis in the next 2 years will be fundamental.
In the last time we had the monetary aggregates growing like they are, or even approaching growth like the rates that we're seeing today, that's to say in the 70s, we had a very active foreign exchange market. We had the U.S. dollar declining really precipitously against the yen, against the Swiss franc, and against what was then the Deutschmark. Today, the foreign exchange market is quiet, and I think if there's a focus, it's probably on Ron. Do you see any opportunities in the foreign exchange market?
Well, you know, that's interesting, because in the 70s, you had at that time that group, you mentioned them, Deutschmark, Swiss franc, yen. It was a group of three that were called hard money currencies. They were hard money currencies because they were growing economies with excellent fiscal positions and very low money growth. And so they were really hard money currencies. And the dollar kept losing value against them through the whole decade of the 70s. Today, the situation is different. Today, almost every one of these countries today has been inflating at about the same rate. I'm not saying necessarily the same rate, but at about the same rate. Now the relative game is a little different. And so it's difficult really to be confident that one can choose which one of these will do better than others. My feeling at the moment, and I'm not sure it's worth betting on that feeling, but my feeling at the moment is that the U.S. dollar is, let's say this, that in a Biden administration where spending is going to be probably more liberal and where the central bank will be called upon to maintain easier money for longer in order to help finance these transitions to, let's say, a non-carbon future or things of that sort. In that kind of environment, I think the dollar is almost certain to fall against, let's say, the euro or the yen, because the amount of laxity, the easiness that they have is going to be greater than those economies. It's not as if they're hard money currencies, the Swiss or the German currency or the German euro, really the euro, or the yen, but relatively speaking, they're a little bit stronger. But I am guessing that the Asian group will probably do better. I believe that because they were less affected by COVID, or because their growth rate may still be a little bit better than ours, a younger economy, that the combination of, you know, Korea and Japan and China and Thailand and Vietnam and Philippines and so on, that group, that whole group will probably do a little bit better than the U.S. dollar. So if we had to measure the U.S. dollar against a basket, say the U.S. dollar may well turn down. I think you can capture that by without having to take a position, a strong position for an exchange. And the way to capture is via commodities and via gold. Gold will do extremely well if the dollar were to weaken. And only a very strong dollar, and again, real rates of interest, which come together, or even if they don't come together, but a strong dollar will be bearish for gold and commodities. A flat dollar or certainly a weak dollar, will be very bullish for gold, as it was in the 70s, and it will be bullish for commodities.
Okay, thank you. You're long a lot of risk assets. You're long a lot of your long commodities. You're long gold. You're long gold miners. You're long builders. But you do have some short positions. Could you talk a little bit about those to wind us up?
Well, the main short position we have, and it's been pared down a little bit, is the short position in Australian banks, which actually is a short position that reflects our general bearish views on the world banking picture, and more particularly in Australia, where they are very dependent on housing and where a large percentage of their lending portfolio is mortgages. And so we believe that they're very vulnerable to a downturn, and they will have to start cutting their dividend. What's holding them up is very high rate, very high yield, dividend yields, 8-9% or so. So we think that that's going to happen. But, you know, the position has been in our books for a while. It's becoming a little bit stale. So I've sort of given myself a limit in sort of in my mind that I will let it ride until maybe the end of the year and see what they do about their dividend policy and what happens to the Australian housing market during that time. And perhaps if nothing much more happens, then I would have to say, well, you know what, this is probably not going to be any more, it's not going to be good enough to be one of our major positions. You know, we are very concentrated. So we need that every piece of that concentration should yield extraordinary results, and it may not. So, but we still have for now, I believe 21% of the portfolio today is of the equity today is Australian banks. The other short position that we have an interesting, let's call it thematic position. And it's one that we had a number of times, but this time we added a little twist to it. We were short a number of times Tesla, on the let's say that the idea was that the stock was very overpriced, very overvalued, and that really wasn't making money. It was just collecting a lot of credits for selling credits, their clean air credits. The company now has made 5 quarters of earnings, but I would say that a good part of those earnings, or maybe most of the earnings, or maybe all the earnings, I'm not really sure, are credits and not profits, corporate profits. But the game here, I believe, is this. They were the first ones. They did it fairly well. One has to give them credit. He did a good job. He fought very hard. There were a number of times that it looked like he was going to go, that the company was going to go under, and he himself rolled up his sleeves and was on the factory floor working, and this company made it through to the point that they expect this year that it will sell somewhere around 500,000 cars, maybe a little less. It won't be as many as 500,000, and he doesn't meet his targets, but let's say that he'll sell maybe 475,000 or 450,000 cars. That's not bad. That's still a small portion of what car companies, the automakers do. And at today's expected earnings coming up, I believe that the company is selling around 800 times expected earnings. Yet, what is significant, they were the first ones, and to that, they get credit for that. But what is significant is that it doesn't, in the capitalist system, these advantages don't stay forever. And there are newcomers coming in. And unfortunately, I say unfortunately for the market, not unfortunately for Tesla, but fortunately for Tesla, but unfortunately for the market, the large Western companies, Volkswagen and General Motors and so on, were unable to mount an attack, a challenge. Only now, after 4 years or 5 years, they're able to start selling some of these. And I'm not really sure they will do it well. But there's one group of companies that will do well, and that is the Chinese companies. The Chinese are very good at imitating products. they are like the, in my opinion, they're like the Japanese of the 60s and 70s and 80s that copied everything that we did and did it better. They came out with better radios, better televisions, better cars. Everything was better and cheaper once we opened the market, once we Americans invented these things and put them into production. I believe that the Chinese are going to do well, very well in this area, and they're going to be the main competitors. And I think against them, Tesla will lose ground, will lose a lot of ground. So the bet that we're making today, in contrast to what we did in the past, we're short. And by the way, the position that we have at the moment is small, 5% of the equity. We're short Tesla, and we are long a Chinese car maker. We picked NIO, but there could be, we may be adding a few other ones because we're not really sure. Nobody really is sure what numbers look like in China, what balance sheets look like, and so on. So, but at the moment we have NIO, but it's a spread. It's a spread. It's a pair trade, what we call a pair trade. And the bet is these Chinese companies, with the backing of their government, was very, very interested. China is very interested in developing the strongest EV market in the world, will give them a run for their money. We'll give Tesla a run for the money, and a serious run for the money. This is not Volkswagen. This is not General Motors. These Chinese companies are very agile, very good at doing things, and they can raise immense amounts of money. Recently, they raised billions of dollars in the capital markets. And so the bet that we have is that Tesla will lose ground in this bear trade. If we get better confirmation of that, we might even increase our position. But for now, it's like a 5% bet, short 5% Tesla and long an offsetting amount of a Chinese automaker. And I believe that that's the only other short position, meaning Australia and Tesla as part of a pair are the only short position that we have. Because in a negative interest rate environment, David, we really want to be long risk assets. That's what we want to do. We want to be long risk assets. We have plenty of time to develop a short position in the future. That is not to say that we won't see substantial corrections along the way. I would not be surprised if the market enters into a correction right at or before or right after the election. But these will be technical in nature. And some of the risk assets will not participate. Some of them will actually do well. So we're keeping an eye on them. We don't want to spend a lot of time, effort, or incur risk in selecting short positions, because we are in an environment, negative interest rate environment, that favors real risk risk assets. But we are aware that these kind of reactions are going to take place, either for disappointments or disappointment in a new package, disappointment about taxes, disappointment about any number of things that can still happen that we don't even know that can happen. Market does look tired at the moment. Looks like it's struggling. It doesn't seem to be making a lot of headway. We're not seeing a lot of new highs in the making, which is not a good sign. Breadth remains flat. So technically speaking, the market is, let's call it, the market is struggling. Volatility indices are still very elevated. That means that the market still expects trouble. So we can't say that there won't be a reaction, a strong reaction. If there is, we're going to be long risk assets that we think will do better, much better as a whole than the market.
Al, I didn't say at the beginning, as I typically do, as I try to do before every call, that we try to keep the call to about 45 minutes. But we're right at the 45 minute mark, and I think you come to a pretty good conclusion. So I'll thank you for your time, and I'll congratulate you on a good quarter. really came back from a near-death experience at the end of March and April. Tremendous courage, tremendous. Got a vision, and we have our fingers crossed that it makes itself manifest. Look forward to seeing you in Toronto, and look forward to talking 3 months from now.
Okay, great. Safe driving, David. Be careful.
Okay. Thank you, Albert.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.